Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
September is historically the worst month for stocks. A lot of people think it's October because we've had some very big crashes in October, single-day declines. But it's really September that is the dreaded month, even though, you know, every once in a while we seem to get a big, big down day in October. But this whole quarter, you know, the fall quarter is, you know, historically where you can get some real weakness. Also in the dollar, strength in precious metals. The dollar started the month off with a big drop. One of the bigger drops we've had, the dollar index lost about 1% in value. Some big movers. The Australian dollar was up about 2 full cents on the day. That's over a 2% move. About a little over a 2% move in the New Zealand dollar. You know, the euro was strong. The Swiss franc made a new 52-week high on the day. It made an all-time record high yesterday against the euro. The Swiss franc has been very strong in the cross-trade against the euro, which is something I have been forecasting for some time, given the fact that the eurozone has been easier than the Swiss, even though the Swiss have been bending over backwards to accommodate the inflation being created in Europe. But the Swiss franc still manages to rally despite the efforts of the government to undermine it. The Japanese yen made a 15-year high early in the week. It pulled back a little bit now that we're getting some movement into the other currencies. Gold, you know, gold gave back a little bit of ground, but it's been very, very strong. In fact, in the month of August, you know, the gold stocks had a fantastic month. Many gold and silver stocks hit 52-week highs. The index itself didn't quite make a new high, but it's close. You know, you can contrast that to the probably the worst performing sector for the month was the financials. They all many of the brokerage firms and banks made new 52-week lows, not just lows for the month, but lows for the 52-week period in August. And you know, a lot of people got suckered into buying those financials when they had that big rally off the lows. But of course, you know, that was all trader-based. I mean, the fundamentals for these financials are atrocious. I mean, there are people making money employed by these companies, but I think the fundamentals are lousy. Many of them are actually insolvent. The only thing that's keeping a lot of these financials alive is the cheap money coming from the Fed. But, you know, that's not an endless supply. At some point, the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates, and when they do, these financials are in a lot of trouble. I tried to point this out on CNBC Fast Monday Money on Monday, and you know, they couldn't see that. I thought part of it was crazy because one of the guys on there, I was trying to explain the negative impact of refinancing. Everybody looks at the refinancing as a win because the borrower gets to save money because his mortgage is lower, and he can use that extra money to go out and shop and buy stuff. Well, there's a loser in that relationship. I mean, there's two sides to a loan. There's the borrower and then there's the lender. And so everybody focuses on what the borrower gains, but nobody focuses on what the lender loses. Now, right now, the lenders can afford these losses because the Fed is making up the difference by keeping short-term rates so low and keeping down the cost of funds. So basically what's happening is the banks are making a huge profit right now based on what the Fed is doing, and some of that profit is being surrendered to borrowers. All right. So, but what's going to happen is when the monetary spigots are turned off, if they're ever turned off, which of course they have to be, and if the Fed is no longer giving away money but charging a reasonable rate for it, I threw out the rate of 7%. What if the Fed funds goes back up to 7%? Well, what is that going to do to all these banks that have now loaned money out for 30 years at 4.5% or 5%? Well, you know, it's one thing when you're borrowing at 0 or 1% and collecting interest at 4%. It's totally different when you're borrowing at 7%. So I'm trying to point out the ticking time bombs that are going to explode in our banking system because we've got the whole thing levered up. You know, they all own cheap, low-yielding mortgages, low-yielding treasuries. And the other guy on CNBC said, well, interest rates will never be 7% in my lifetime. In his lifetime, this guy's a lot younger than me. He's in his 30s. He doesn't think in the next 60 years that interest rates will ever be 7%. I mean, how crazy that is? You know what it takes to get interest rates at 7%? You need, I mean, a CPI going around 4 or 5%. I mean, if you get 5% inflation, I mean, you pretty much need 7% interest rates just to get 2% real rate of interest. And, of course, if the Fed is going to get aggressive and try to fight an inflation rate that's rising, it's got to get ahead of the curve. So basically, he's saying inflation is never going to be 5% in his lifetime. In his lifetime. Given, you know, so people are just closing their eyes and refusing to see what should completely be obvious. I mean, this should be as obvious as the housing bubble or the internet bubble. But, of course, as obvious as these bubbles look in hindsight, and sure, so many people now can come up and say, oh, of course I saw this coming. Oh, of course this was crazy. Nothing down mortgages, ninja loans, no DAC. Oh, of course that was stupid. Yeah, believe me, back in 2004 and 2005, nobody thought that way. I got into more arguments about the housing market than family members, friends, anybody. Nobody could see this, even though it was so obvious to me. And it's so obvious to so many people in hindsight. You know, I mean, why do you think all these subprime mortgages were rated AAA when they were really zero? Because most people couldn't see what should have been obvious. And it's the same thing with this bond bubble. It's the same. This is so simple, yet so many people are oblivious to this danger. Now, of course, once it blows up, it's all going to be quite clear to everybody. You know, oh, yeah, yeah, of course. But they can't see that now. But anyway, so the dollar, I started to say, is got off to a very weak day at the beginning of this quarter. And to me, you know, what's going on, and this is what I think a lot of people still have not figured out, is the decoupling. You know, it was about a month ago or 2 months ago, everybody was talking about, oh no, are the problems in Europe going to derail the U.S. recovery? Are the problems in Greece, is this psychology going to spill over and screw up the U.S. recovery? Well, the thing is, there was no U.S. recovery, so there was nothing to screw up. But all of a sudden now, the economic data coming out of Europe is far stronger than the data coming out of the United States. And, of course, it's much stronger coming out of Asia and some of the other countries like Australia, which came out with strong data yesterday, as well as China. And so now the talk is, well, is the U.S. slowdown going to screw up the global recovery? So that's a big switch from where it was a month or two ago. And you remember back then, and if you don't remember, go and play some of these older shows from back then. I always said that there were problems in Europe, but the problems here were much bigger. And I think that the global recovery is real. I think that the global economy would be recovering better had foreign governments not done any of their stimulus. You know, you've got a lot of economies. Let's take Australia, for example, where, you know, the economy is doing really well, and the Australian politicians want to claim credit, and they'll say, aha, it's because we did the stimulus. Well, I think the recovery would have been better without the stimulus. But, you know, there's no way to prove any of that. You can't. But the politicians will certainly try to take credit. That's why politicians always want to do something, because whatever they do, they'll take credit. I mean, look at Obama, right? They did the stimulus, and they're still taking credit, even though the economy is bad, because they say, well, without the stimulus, it would have been worse. Now, how do you argue with that? How do you prove that? You see, if they had done nothing, right, which would have been the good thing, and let's say the economy were still weak, but not as weak as it is today, they would have been criticized for doing nothing. So the politicians always want to do something, even if what they do makes the situation worse, because they can always lie about it. They can always say, well, I hear guys on television now saying, if it wasn't for the Obama stimulus, unemployment would be 14%. So it's a good thing that we did it. We should be lucky that it's only, you know, 9.5%. I mean, that is the problem. But, you know, so the global economies, despite the stimuluses, are recovering, right? They are overcoming the damage they did with the stimulus, and they're recovering anyway. Stimulus was so much bigger, therefore it did so much more damage, and the patient was already much sicker when the stimulus dose was administered. The U.S. economy is fundamentally flawed. It's completely screwed up. It can't exist. That's not the case abroad. Yes, the economies aren't perfect. They would be functioning better if they had less government and more free enterprise. But the problem with our economy is very different. It's structural. Our structure is screwed up because of years and years of issuing the world's reserve currency, of living beyond our means, and years and years of allowing more government debt, more regulation and taxation to undermine the foundation of our economy. So we've destroyed that foundation, and we've replaced it with something completely phony. And as that phony foundation gave way, we're still trying to prop it up with more of the same. But what I think is happening is people are now worried, right? The story is, okay, the global economy is growing, but things look bad in the U.S., and if the U.S. slips into the double dip, well, it's obviously going to drag down the rest of the world, just like it did in 2008. Well, I'm still going to stick with my story that ain't going to happen. It happened in 2008. I don't think it's going to happen again. Can I be wrong? Will I look pretty foolish, I suppose, if I whiff that same pitch, if I make the same mistake twice? I guess. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think there's a mistake in 2008. I think so many people now expect the next downturn to look like the last downturn, which is, you know, usually all anybody can see is look at what already happened and assume that that's going to happen again. But I don't think it is. Remember, you know, I expected when I wrote, if you go back and read Crash Proof and you read what I wrote, what was going to happen to foreign stock markets, I wrote that when the housing bubble burst and we got the initial collapse in the U.S. stock market, we got a big sell-off, a big drop in housing prices. When our recession began, I wrote that foreign stock markets were going to sell off in sympathy with ours, that the world was going to overreact to the problems in the United States, and it was going to sell off U.S. stocks. That's why I wrote that whole chapter on liquidity. I said keep some cash ready because I expect there to be some big bargains that will occur when people do the wrong thing, when people throw out the baby with the bathwater. So I did expect foreign stocks to go down, and they did. The only thing I did not anticipate was the movements in the foreign exchange market. I assumed that the world would be smart enough to know that this collapse was bad for the dollar, right? I overestimated the intelligence of the global community, right? I erred in not figuring out that they would do the exact wrong thing, that the same people who didn't understand the crisis before it happened, they wouldn't understand it after it happened, and they would foolishly buy the dollar, which is exactly what they did. So when I advised people to buy foreign stocks, knowing that a crash was coming, I thought that the foreign stocks would go down a lot less than U.S. stocks because I expected the dollar to go down and the strengthening foreign currencies to cushion the effect of falling stock prices, which I expected to happen. Now, I also expected gold to go up immediately because with a weak dollar, gold would have gone up. Now, the dollar went up, so gold ended up going down. So initially, the movements in the dollar undermined the short-term performance of what were my long-term investment strategy. And, of course, a lot of people like to point out, oh, look, you know, look what happened in 2008. You know, Peter Schiff had the exact wrong strategy for 2008. Sure, it was wrong in 2008. That was the only year in 10. Of the last 10 years, I think the only year where you were better off in U.S. stocks than foreign stocks was 2008. But unfortunately, that's the year everybody looks at because that's the year that we had the big collapse. But in that initial period, that was when all these private banks were failing, private insurance companies, and you had all these European and Asian creditors who were owed money by these banks who were now in jeopardy of getting paid back. They didn't know how it was going to wind out. We had this global credit crunch, and the world suffered. But this time around, that's not the fear. See, this next big decline, it's not going to be the private businesses that are in trouble. It's the government itself. It's the federal government. The federal government has already nationalized all these debts. It's nationalized all the Freddie and Fannie debt. The federal government has already put the U.S. taxpayer on the hook for this. This is not about a private debt. This is now government. This is now sovereign debt. The government is now in bed with the banks. The government is not going to let them fail again. It's all a sovereign problem. So this next collapse, it's not going to be, you know, private companies that the U.S. government can bail out. It's the U.S. government that nobody can bail out, right? The U.S. the government convinced us that the businesses were too big to fail. Well, we know the government is too big to bail. And as a sovereign crisis, if you want to look at what happens to countries that have a sovereign crisis, look what happened to Iceland. Look what happened to Greece. That's what's going to happen to the United States. People haven't figured out that that's the kind of country we are. So I think if we do have another leg down, which I believe is coming in the U.S. economy, that it's not going to look like 2008 because it's not going to create this global credit crunch. It's going to be the exact opposite. It's not going to cause a flight to the dollar. It's going to cause the flight from the dollar. That the currency crisis that I saw coming is coming. Maybe it's starting 2 years later than the initial collapse. And I wrote an article, one of my commentaries, it's up on the Europac website some time ago, and I said, you know, the creditors take the jab, but the debtor is going to take the knockout. And the analogy was that in the initial part of the crisis, it actually, the creditors lost, it looked like they took the bigger hit. The people that loaned us all the money to gamble and spend, they got the initial jab. But that we were going to get the counterpunch, we were going to get the knockout as the debtor, as the borrower, as the economy that really is screwed up. And so what's happening is I think the global economies are recovering because they were sound. Yes, they loaned too much money to America, but beneath the surface were the economies that were capable of generating the surpluses that they loaned us. Yes, the world sold America too much stuff on credit, but their economies are still capable of producing the stuff they sold us and generating the savings they loaned us. So, yes, they didn't use their resources wisely, but they have them. We don't have the resources, right? We use their resources. We borrowed and squandered their money. We consumed their production. We're the country that's really screwed up, right? We need to take care of that, but instead of allowing the market to solve the problems the government created, the government just created more and prevented the market from solving these problems. So now we're more screwed up than we were before. And the global economy is recovering. I mean, think about it this way. What was the global economy looking like before we fell apart? It's, well, the world makes a bunch of stuff. They earn a lot of money, and then they take their money that they earned. They loan it to us so that we can buy the stuff that they made, so that they can ship the stuff over here. Well, what if they cut out the middleman? What if instead of making stuff and then loaning us the money to buy the stuff, what if they make the stuff, don't loan us any money, and then buy the stuff themselves with the money that they no longer loan us? That is what is happening. And if you look at all the numbers coming out of Asia, look at the increased trade going on between Europe and Asia, right, and between Asian nations and other Asian nations. They're trading more with one another. They're selling goods to people that can afford to buy them with their own goods. This is changing. If you want to call it decoupling, it is happening. Maybe it's taken a couple of years, and I don't know, people can criticize me. They think, ah, there's Peter Schiff again, you know, saying the same old nonsense about decoupling. Well, it's not nonsense. People need to open their eyes, especially when you appreciate that we are the caboose. We are not the engine. You can decouple the caboose, and the other trains will move faster. The fact that 2008 didn't look like that, you know, that's a fake out. That has got so many people going the wrong way. That's why most people are going to miss this. Most people are going, you know, the markets will generally try to do what they need to do to fool the most number of people, to make the most people lose as much money as possible. And I think that's what's going to happen. And people are going to fight that battle for a long time. How much further the dollar is going to have to fall, how much more economic data. Maybe after another couple of quarters or a year, if we actually see the U.S. slip into recession and we still see growth coming out of the rest of the world. But we are seeing that. I believe it's happening now. Now, of course, as I said, I was wrong about 2008. I could be wrong again, right? That's always the risk you take, right? I think that we people need to be piling out of the dollar, that we need to be buying foreign stocks. And is it possible that everything could collapse again and it'll be just like it was in 2008 and I could be just as wrong. Yeah, that's the risk you got to take. I don't believe that's going to happen, right? I think that it happened once. It ain't going to happen again. Too many people are looking for it. No, very few people were looking for it last time. A lot of people are looking for it this time. And even the people that were looking for a big drop were looking for it many times the wrong reasons. But you got to take, you got to decide. You know, it's your money. People work hard for their money. You got to decide how to protect it. You got to try to figure out. These are difficult times. I personally believe that the majority of people are going to get wiped out. Right? That's my belief. And so people have to decide, you know, if they accept that, and if do they want to be, do you want to be somebody who doesn't get wiped out? And now, could you get wiped out following my advice? Maybe. You could get wiped out ignoring my advice. Because there are a lot of people that have different opinions than me. But that's why I encourage people to do their own homework. You know, look at the stuff that I've been saying or read the stuff that I've been writing. Go back, look at other people and what they've been saying and try to make a decision on your own. You know, what makes sense? To me, I think that any way you look at it, you know, even if you don't buy into my gloom and doom for the United States, how can anybody look at the global economy and not believe over the long run it's going to outgrow the U.S.? When we have so many headwinds, all this debt, all these problems, all these entitlements, the socialist agenda, how can the U.S. economy do better than the rest of the world? I just don't even see how it's possible. So even if everything is good, you got to get more growth abroad. So stocks have got to do better. And you're paying less. You're getting lower PEs by buying foreign stocks. You're getting much higher dividend yields. So in order to outperform, in order the U.S. to outperform, it's like it's got to, not only does the U.S. market have to go up, it has to go up so much more than the foreign markets just to out overcome the yield disadvantage. And then, of course, how can the dollar not decline over time? I don't see how that's even possible, which means you really have to hit it out of the park to make money in the U.S. So for me, it's a no-brainer, you know. But, you know, everybody's got to do their own homework. Anyway, before I go to the phones, I wanted to just make one comment about Obama's speech last night. I thought the most scary part of his speech, you know, and I welcome the fact that, you know, we're bringing people out of Iraq. I thought we never should have gone into Iraq in the first place. So I'm glad that we are making progress on pulling some people out of Iraq. But I was very scared to hear Obama's call for another GI Bill, like this after the Second World War. Now, I haven't seen any legislation. That's the first time I've heard him say that. But imagine what this thing is going to cost us. Because, you know, when the Second World War ended, college was cheap. I forget what the GI Bill cost. It was $100 a month or something per guy. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money. Imagine what it's going to cost to send all the vets to college in today's inflated market with these kind of tuitions. How much? I mean, is this really coming, a new GI Bill? Are we going to send everybody to college? What's that going to cost? Where's that money going to come from? You know, what's that? And, of course, is it going to do any good to take able-bodied young Americans? We need them working and send them off to some overpriced university to spend 4 or 5 years getting a worthless degree and then come out and be unemployed? Now, some people might say, well, there's no jobs for them anyway. There would be jobs for them if the government got out of the way. I mean, there is an endless supply of jobs. If people aren't working, it's because there's some government rule or regulation preventing them from working. Otherwise, they'd work. Now, maybe it's because wages are too high and the government is preventing wages from coming down, or the government is artificially increasing the cost of labor with taxes or regulations, or the government is subsidizing people. The government is creating an incentive for people not to take jobs that are available. They do all these things. But absent the government, everybody's going to work, because if you don't work, you'll starve, right? You won't have food. You won't have clothes. So people are going to work. They'll either work for somebody else or they'll go out and work for themselves. But when the government comes in there and destroys incentive, destroys initiative, makes it impossible for employees and employers to come together and strike a bargain, or sometimes makes it impossible for people to go out and work for themselves. So it's always the government that's doing this. And if you're going to prevent people from working, and then because they're unemployed, you're going to send them to college, but then you're going to tax the people who are working to pay the bills, you're going to destroy those jobs. And then, of course, when the people graduate with these degrees, there's no jobs. So the whole thing is a disaster. But we'll see if there's, you know, what Obama does about any kind of new GI Bill. And I'm sure there isn't a single politician with the guts to vote against it. After all, who's going to want to say, I don't want to support the troops. I'm against, you know, I'm against showing our gratitude to the troops by sending them to college, you know. But believe me, there's a lot better things we can do for the troops than waste taxpayer money getting worthless liberal arts degrees. If we actually gave the troops a viable economy, if we can shrink government, repeal rules and regulations, so the troops can come home to the free country that they fought for, so that they can actually achieve the American dream. This all going to be a bunch of nonsense talking about how much we care about the troops is measured by how much money we're willing to waste to get them these worthless college diplomas. Anyway, let me go to the phones. First caller is Heyman in New York. Go ahead.
Yes, hello, Peter. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes. All right. My first comment is, I like the article that Mike Pence put out in the Forbes publication saying that Bernanke may be out of bullets, but he's not out of bombs.
That was just out today.
Yeah, I thought that was real good. And everything you're saying about the bond market bubble is completely true. One thing you didn't speak about, though, the insurance, the CDS spread on treasuries have actually gone up about 35%. I don't know if it's the last 5 days or 5 weeks, but I heard somebody say that on CNBC, and I wanted you to briefly comment on that. And then I have one more question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the odds are that the federal government's going to default on its debt. I mean, you know, I think they're more likely to inflate, which is another form of default, but technically they pay you in money that has a little value. But the other thing is, if the U.S. government didn't pay on its debt and actually defaulted, would the companies who are insuring the U.S. government debt, you know, would they be able to pay? I doubt it. See, that's why I think it's almost like crazy to buy default swaps on U.S. debt. Because if the U.S. government does default, there's a good chance that whoever wrote that insurance is going to default too, because they're not going to be able to pay all the claims.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. And something about real estate. Now, I live in New York City, and I just don't believe anything that come out of realtors' mouths, because there's no way. I truly believe that real estate is not supply and demand, because there's no way that the majority of New Yorkers can afford the real estate.
Well,
the prices of the real estate, it's just way, way, way too high. Thank you very much.
Real estate salesmen are, you know, they're like used car salesmen, or they're worse. I mean, their job is to get you to buy a house, and they will come up with any kind of rationale. And, of course, they always try to convince you that you're not making a purchase, that you're making an investment. They want you to think that this is your ticket to Easy Street, because that's what gets you, that's why you buy it, because they get you to think that you're not spending money, you're making money. It's always a good time to buy. Now, you can make the same thing with me and say, well, you're a stockbroker, so you're always going to tell people to buy stocks. No. Well, I'm going to tell people to buy stocks that have good value, that pay good dividends. I mean, I'm going to try to find, if all stocks were overpriced, if I couldn't find any stocks anywhere in the world that I thought was a good value, I wouldn't tell you to buy stocks. I'd tell you to short them, or I'd tell you to buy to buy a bonds, or I'd tell you to buy your, I'd find, or commodities. I mean, I'll find something that's worth investing in. But a real estate agent, if they think that you shouldn't buy, then all they can do is quit, because they're selling real estate. If they think real estate is overpriced, they can't tell you the truth, because if you're selling real estate, you got to make a sale of real estate. You can't tell somebody to rent, you know, because you're not going to make any commission telling them to rent. No matter, and a lot of them actually get caught up in it. I mean, a lot of people believe in it. They believe their own bullshit, so they're not deliberately lying. I mean, this is what they think. You know, now they're, you know, but you can't listen to anything a realtor says. I mean, it's all, you just tell them right out loud. Look, it's, you know, it's all bull. You decide, you make your own determination. But they're always going to tell you to buy, and they're always going to tell you you're throwing your money away on rent. No matter how much cheaper renting is, they'll tell you you're throwing your money away. Anyway, now that I've offended all the realtors who are listening, but if there's anybody who's listening, they can call me up and confer.
Thank you.
Anyway, all right, thanks for the call. All right, next up is going to be Clive in Oregon.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
Not bad. Do you have a favorite English-speaking country for a would-be expat?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of countries that speak English now. I mean, as far as where English is the national language, you know, we're like Australia or New Zealand or Canada or the UK. I mean, but there are a lot of countries where there are a lot of expatriates that already live. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't lived abroad. I mean, I've traveled to some countries, and so a lot of it just depends on you, where you have friends, how often you want your friends to visit you, or do you want to come back to the States, or, you know, what cultures you like, what languages you may or may not speak, or, you know, there are a lot of places in the world that you can live. There's places in South America, there's places in, you know, all around the world that people can choose to live. And they're pretty big, you know, there are a lot of American communities. I mean, Central America, I mean, I know there's a lot of Americans down in Costa Rica.
How do you think Canada's going to do after the dollar collapses?
Well, I think Canada's going to do pretty good because I think Canada, you know, they have very strong trade relationships outside of the United States. They've got a lot of natural resources. And I think Canada is going to benefit from an influx of American labor. I think a lot of Americans are going to move to Canada. And that's going to be a positive because it's not going to be the slackers that are going to move up there. It's going to be the ones that are hardworking and that want to succeed and recognize that they have a better opportunity up there. So that's going to benefit Canada. I think they'll do all right.
Do you think there's any value in finishing school at this point, or should one just try to settle into any kind of productive, sustainable activity?
Oh, I don't know. It depends on how far along you are, what your major is, what you're learning. I mean, you know, I've thought to people that, you know, nowadays, I mean, just a basic bachelor's degree in liberal arts is pretty much worthless. Everybody's got them. It's almost like if you don't have one, then it's a problem. But if you do have one, you know, you really haven't accomplished anything, but just made yourself like everybody else. I mean, I'm not telling people, you know, advice if kids say, what would I do probably if I was young? I'd probably skip college entirely and just pretend I went. You know, I went to UC Berkeley. I mean, I got a couple of jobs. I don't think anybody ever checked. I mean, it's not like maybe if I said I was at Harvard, but if somebody came to me and said, yeah, I went to the University of Wisconsin, and they had already been, you know, and they had graduated 5 years ago, you think I would check? No. I mean, I don't think I've ever called up the university to verify it. Now, if the guy said he went to, I graduated top of my class at Harvard, I might think, well, let's verify that. But I mean, just because you assume people went to college. I mean, who would make up a BS degree, you know, from at Chico State or something? So, yeah, but the thing is, they've driven the cost of college now so high, I don't even think it's actually worth it based on the real skills that you acquire, you know. And, of course, once you've had, even if someone went right from high school to work, as opposed to a guy that spent 5 years getting his degree, after 5 years of real work experience, I mean, you know, you don't need a college degree to be a stockbroker. You don't need one to get a Series 7, you know.
Do you like science and engineering degrees?
Yeah, I mean, I like degrees where you actually learn something tangible. You know, I mean, if you get a degree where you just study, you know, history or philosophy or I mean, those are good if you're going to be a professor or if you're going to go to law school and it helps you, you know. But, I mean, if you're not going for like a master's or PhD to be, if you're just going to get a four-year degree and then go out into the workforce, I mean, what good is, you know, some of these, degrees. You know, it's not giving you anything practical to just going out and getting, you know, working. That's why, I mean, a lot of Americans didn't have college degrees. I mean, you know, go back, you know, our grandparents. I mean, not that many people went to college. I mean, you went to college if you wanted to be a lawyer, if you wanted to be a doctor. But, I mean, there are people with college degrees that are working in restaurants, you know, that are driving taxi cabs, that, you know, that are doing all kinds of jobs that really you don't need a college degree to do.
Is there anywhere in the U.S. economy that you think a person is relatively safe, like jumping on a fishing boat or working as a farmhand or something like that?
I don't know. Nobody is safe in America. I mean, there's always a government that's ready to pass a law that could put you out of work or a new regulation or new tax. I think if you have real skills, you know, that are marketable where you can leave. But, you know, yeah, certain things, I mean, I said certain industries that I know are going to be, growing in agriculture and mining and, you know, in certain industries and in computers and high tech. I mean, there's certain skills that you have that, you know, that are going to be in demand. It's just, it might be harder and harder to monetize those skills in the United States if the U.S. government keeps encumbering our businesses with regulations and taxes to the point where the best way to take advantage of your skills is to leave the country and put them to work someplace else. I mean, that's and that is the direction that we're heading. That's what's so tragic about what's going on. You know, because we are in serious trouble, but I know that everything the government is doing is making it worse, and the minute they make it worse, their solution is, oh, we need more of what made it worse, and now it gets even worse than that. So it's like we are stuck in this downward spiral, and there's really no way out of it right now unless someone completely throws a monkey wrench in this machine. And right now, I don't know where that wrench is going to come from. I mean, I tried to do it myself by running for the Senate, but that didn't work. So,
okay, well, thanks a lot, Peter.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. All right, next up is Chris from New York.
Hey, Peter.
How's it going?
Good. So I have one comment and one question. My first comment is I read the your book, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes. I loved it. And I think the two best concepts I came away from reading it were right in the first chapter. The first concept is savings, which I think has been lost on everyone in this country somehow, and definitely on TV and all the talk shows. And the second concept is that, you know, the spirit of entrepreneurship and how everyone benefits from when somebody wants to better their own situation. And I think the book did a beautiful job of explaining that. You know, I've explained it to people who are, you know, the most anti-business people on earth, and they think, you know, it's the corporations that are corrupt, and, you know, no one's perfect in this world, but when you really
break
it down...
Yeah, I mean,
those
are very basic concepts. You know, I was listening to this argument debate on CNBC today between a guy, you know, they're talking about bringing back the estate tax or whether you should have an estate tax or, and of course it comes back automatically next year, 55% of everything above $1 million or something like this. It's horrific. And this guy's like, we need this tax because we need to raise money, but it is such a bad tax because it destroys the ability of an individual to grow a business beyond his lifetime. And it forces your heirs to have to liquidate your business to pay the taxes, and it destroys the capital, it destroys the employment opportunities. It is the most destructive tax ever devised. It raises very little revenue, but it does massive damage, and the only reason we have it is because it makes people feel good, because we're punishing somebody, because we don't want them to inherit something. And we forget that, you know, we base the inheritance tax, the whole thing is unconstitutional. It's based on the privilege. See, the government cannot tax an inheritance because it would have to apportion it, right? Direct taxes have to be apportioned, right? That maybe that's different for the income tax because of the 16th Amendment, but the estate tax is not the income tax. There is no amendment that says they can tax estates without regard to apportionment. So in order to get around the apportionment provision of the Constitution, Congress levied a tax on the privilege of leaving your property to your children. But that's not a privilege. If you own the property, you have a right to give it away. So the government claims that a right is a privilege so they can tax it. But they're just trying to punish. They're trying to say it's not fair that somebody should inherit a bunch of money, so let's take it away from them. Yeah, life isn't fair, right? But it doesn't mean that then you go and steal it. But you look at the damage that is done, you know, and the businesses that, you know, are liquidated. I mean, the beauty of capitalism is that you can accumulate it. Over generations, you can have a business that you can build and protect it for your kids, for your grandkids, that they can be handed down from generation to generation so parents can teach their kids how to run the business so they're efficient at it and they're constantly improving. Everybody benefits. And then you come in with this crazy estate tax and you do so much damage. For what? So a bunch of politicians can get elected by saying, hey, it's not fair that this guy inherits money and you don't, so let's take it. Despite the fact that the person who earned it paid taxes his entire life while he earned it. Now you're just taxing the same money all over again. And at 55%, I mean, that's horrific.
All right.
Anyway,
well, I agree with all that. And anybody listening to the show right now, you should read the book. It's great. The second, my question is, what I anticipate happening is some type of program. I think, you know, just... from talking to everyday people, that there's going to be a credit card problem pretty soon. And I can see major government buying of, you know, credit products or
credit card.
Well, they're already buying. Look, the Federal Reserve already bought up a bunch of credit card debt. They've already interfered in that market. And that is all of this securitized debt, where it's securitized with auto loans, credit cards, student loans. It's all blowing up. It's all on life support from the Fed because Americans have simply borrowed too much money. They can't pay it back. They don't have the assets to pay it back. They were counting on their home equity. You remember what was happening for a while is people were maxing out their credit cards. And then once they maxed them out, they refinanced their house. They rolled the credit card debt into their mortgage and then repeated the whole process. And it was like, well, but you can't do it anymore because the home equity is gone. So the music has stopped. But now the new credit card debt has run up. There's no place to refinance it to. People have the student loans, the car loans. Meanwhile, a lot of people are now unemployed. So not only don't they have any home equity, they don't have an income. People are borrowing on their Visa to pay the interest on their MasterCard.
Right. Well, that to me seems like the last thing that people have right now. That's the last final piece of grease that's keeping it going, just from everyday people.
One of the reasons that people – look, once you have a negative net worth, let's say your net worth is negative $20,000. Why not borrow another 10? Why not? I mean, what's the difference? Go out with a bang. I think once Americans are so indebted that they know they can't pay it off, they're just going to borrow as much as people are dumb enough to lend them. Because it just means that, you know, if you're going to go bankrupt, why go bankrupt owing $20,000? Go bankrupt owing $100,000. I mean, the bigger the better, right? I mean, you might as well get as much free as you can, because once you declare bankrupt and you've gone bankrupt and it's on your record, it doesn't matter how big the bankruptcy was, right? It doesn't matter if it was $20,000 or $200,000. So you might as well take out as much money as you possibly can if you know. Now, if you know that you're going to try to pay off your debts, then you wouldn't want to do that. If you're planning on paying off your debts, then you're not going to want to take on bigger debts. But once you've kind of figured out that you're not going to pay, and I think the government has probably pretty much created the idea that, you know what, we're probably going to bail you out. So take on a lot of debt. We bailed out the banks. We're trying to bail out the homeowners. You know, we're bailing out the students. We'll bail out the credit card debtors. I mean, so I think we've created that idea that, well, you know, the more trouble I'm in, the more I owe, the more likely it is I'm going to qualify for some kind of bailout. So, you know, I might as well really put myself in a weak position, because now then I'm better, you know, I'm more likely to get bailed out. You know?
Right. Well, I'd like to sneak in one last question. It's not an easy one, and I've heard you address this issue a million times, but I never fully understood your explanation, and it's the whole U.S. versus Japan. And I don't want, you know, I've heard you say over and over that, well, Japan was in a different situation. They had surpluses. Why no inflation, though? How come they haven't experienced
Well, here's
inflation?
The thing. What you don't understand is if the Bank of Japan had not printed all that money, prices in Japan would have fallen by a lot more. So the inflation is the difference between how much prices would have fallen had they not created the inflation and how much they did fall or rose with the inflation. You see, the Japanese economy was denied the benefits of lower prices by the inflation that the Japanese government created. That is a real loss. You just can't see it because of the overlying productivity of the Japanese economy. They produced enough to offset the effects of the inflation. So prices didn't go up, but they didn't drop. And that would have been a good thing. It would have helped the Japanese economy recover had prices fallen.
And you're simply saying that the U.S. can't mimic that situation?
No, because we're starting from a position of weakness. We don't have the savings. We don't have the credits. We don't have the net exports. We're already loaded up in debt. And remember, the Japanese were able to borrow that money from themselves. We can't borrow the money from ourselves. Right. We have to borrow it from them. We have to borrow it from China. We need the whole world lending us money. The Japanese government only needed Japan to lend it money. So this is a much bigger problem. We can't do it. You know, we've been living beyond our means for a couple of generations now. That wasn't the case in Japan. They were never living beyond their means. Now the government is living beyond its means, but the nation isn't, because the people can afford to support this government. Now, at some point, look, I think at some point Japan is going to pay an even bigger price. I think you are going to see prices really starting to move up. I think there is a time bomb there in Japan. But remember, before the Japanese time bomb goes off, they are sitting on about $1 trillion worth of treasuries. So before Japan goes broke, we got to go broke first, because we owe them $1 trillion. They don't owe us anything.
Right.
Anyway, thanks for your calls.
I appreciate it.
All right, I got three more people on hold. I got about 14 minutes, so I'll try to get to the three callers. No more calls. The next caller is John from Connecticut.
Hello, Peter.
Hey, John, how are you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask you about recent comments from I'm a Euro-Pacific client, and recently Euro-Pacific senior market strategist John Brown made some comments that he thought deflation was a potential risk. And, as I have heard, and especially through my contact at Euro-Pacific, it was always about, the dollar devaluing. I certainly buy into that argument long term. Is Mr. Brown talking about short term?
Well, deflation is what we need, right? The Fed inflated a bubble. It needs to deflate. Prices need to fall in line with the market. So real estate prices have to come down. You know, they're too high, right? We need to have a credit, that has to happen. So that is a healthy process. The government is fighting off that process. So when John Brown says, yes, deflation, yes, the bubble is deflating. But unfortunately, the federal government is not letting that happen. The federal government is counteracting that by creating money.
Well, I understand.
And that is what's happening.
I understand in their Keynesian way, they now, are scared of deflation, and they will try to fight it.
And here's the problem. If we have legitimate deflation and the government responds to it legitimately, then the dollar will not fall in value. And what I mean by that is we allow prices to fall, we allow banks to fail, and we don't bail them out. We don't bail them out. And we allow the government to default on debt, right? Because part of the deflation is going to mean the federal government can't afford to make the payments on the debt. So if the Federal Reserve sits by and allows the markets to deflate, allows prices to collapse, allows banks to fail, allows the government to default, if the Fed does all that, then the dollar won't collapse, right? But if it doesn't do that, if it tries to bail people out, then the dollar will collapse. And so that's what I'm saying, and I think John Brown's on the same page.
Well, I think he was also warning that if deflation were to really occur, I mean, you would definitely see a lower overall earnings. Say, for example, if you measure by S&P, the earnings per share would go down.
Everything would go down.
Right.
Wages, earnings would go down, prices would go down, wages would go down. The whole price structure would go down. Who that hurts is the government. Because their tax revenues would go down, and they couldn't afford to pay back the money that they borrowed. Deflation hurts debtors, it benefits savers, and it actually benefits the economy, because the problem is things are too expensive. I mean, wouldn't it be great if education costs came down, if healthcare costs came down, if housing costs came down, if energy costs came down, if the cost of living came down, of course that'd be good.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I agree with you from that standpoint. I think The two big questions, of course, or one big question is, what happens to our gold and silver precious metals investment?
Well, look, if the Fed allows deflation, gold prices will fall too. But they won't fall as much as housing prices. They won't fall as much as stock prices. So you're still going to be better off. All that matters is how much can you buy for your gold. So if we have real deflation where the Fed lets it happen, gold prices are going to come down like other prices. They just won't come down as much. So the people who own gold will be better off than the people who own stock or real estate. But that's not what's going to happen. You see, I'm betting that the government will do the wrong thing, that the government will fight deflation, that the government will print as much money as they have to. And that's what they're going to do. And that's what some people who are in this deflation camp, somehow they don't think that's going to happen. They actually think that they're going to have this huge complete collapse of prices because they think the Fed is out of bullets. But as Mike Pinto pointed out today, maybe they're out of bullets, but they're not out of bombs. They've got some nuclear ones that they can drop.
Yeah.
And they will drop. They call it the nuclear option. But they will use it. Thanks for your call.
All right, thanks.
Next up is going to be Adam in Michigan. Go ahead, Adam.
Hey, Peter. Hey, I got one comment I want to make. One of your guys, I'm a customer of yours, client of yours, and one of your guys, Richard Cloutier, has been really good to me. He's down in your north. It's in Florida.
Palm Beach.
Yeah, I love him. He's great.
Thank you.
And so my other question is, are you familiar with what a precinct delegate is?
No.
Okay. It's like the most grassroots form of government, and basically what we do is, it's an unpaid position, and we get to go to the county convention and the state convention where, you know, we vote for, like, attorney general, secretary of state, and stuff like that. So my question to you is how I want to get more involved in city government, like at a city level, and eventually like a county commissioner. And I study Austrian economics. In fact, I've got Henry Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson, in front of me, and there's other books from your recommended reading that I'm...
Did you read my new one on how an economy grows and why it crashes?
No, I haven't gotten that one yet. I got your other two, but...
Yeah, we'll pick that one up.
I will. But listen, with my background on Austrian economics and, like, you know, pretty much the same principles that you believe in and Ron Paul believes in, how can I make an impact at like a county commissioner level, like in state government?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you can get yourself elected, I mean, I thought if I could, you know, get elected, if I had the time or if I wanted to get into local politics, you know, just my own town of Weston, I mean, you know, we overpay. I mean, I would try, you know, you try to introduce, you know, look, maybe you could do some kind of school voucher system. I mean, we overpay. I mean, in our we have great schools here, but we dramatically overpay. I mean, what we're spending, it's amazing. I mean, what we spend per pupil in Weston on the school system, it's outrageous. But it's because it's run by bureaucrats. Why can't we have it run by entrepreneurs? You know, trying to introduce free markets into anywhere the city can try to privatize things that it does, right? Try to put something in the hands of somebody who will run it for a profit. See, as I mentioned before, I got into this argument with a socialist on the campaign trail. He was a socialist because he wants to put people before profits. And I explained to him that, well, but that's what a businessman does. They always put people before profits because that's how they make a profit. See, the bureaucrats, they never put people first because it doesn't matter. They can piss off all their customers because they're stuck. There's no competition. There's no incentive to do good. You don't get paid. If you're a bureaucrat, you make the same money whether you do a lousy job or whether you do a good job. In the private sector, it doesn't work that way. You do a good job, you make more. You do a bad job, you make less, or you get fired. So the more that we can introduce free market incentives into a local economy, the more efficient it's going to run. The more everybody is going to benefit from everybody else's hard work and everybody else's desire to better their own lives. Because, you know, now, yes, we do need governments to make sure that there's no fraud going on, to make sure that people honor their contracts, to enforce the laws. But, you know, the problem is governments try to do a lot more than that, right? Governments, many of them operate on the idea that some things are so important that governments need to provide them. Well, you know, the things that are the most important, those are not the things you want the government to provide. If they're so important, you want the free market to provide them because they are important. You want to make sure that they're there, that they're available, that they're cost effective, that the public gets what they want. And the only way that the public will get what they want, if it's a private entrepreneur who's giving it to them. But anyway,
right.
Well, thanks. I wish you luck, you know, in your local town.
Yeah, because I'm thinking about running, maybe even running for mayor of my town. I mean,
well,
it's a small town.
We need libertarians in government. The problem is most libertarians don't want to be in government because they understand that it's a necessary evil and they don't want to be a part of it. But unfortunately, the people in office have done so much damage that we're going to need people to leave the free market and to go into government and to try to keep the bureaucrats out.
Exactly. Well, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Last caller of the night, Greg from New Hampshire. Go ahead, Greg.
Thanks, Peter. Two questions. First, I'm a Europac client and also have invested in the birthman certificate program. Mm-hmm. But my first question is, assuming that inflation, you know, gets out of hand like in Zimbabwe, I know I've read that the people there actually use the U.S. dollar as a means of exchange.
Yeah, well, they'll have to start using something else, like the euro or the yen or gold bullion. But, yeah, there are a lot of foreign countries that have been dollarized that are using the dollar because their own currencies are no good. See, I think that's going to happen in America one day. One day Americans are going to be using gold or euros or some other currency because they're not going to be using the dollar.
Well, that's what I was thinking, and I was wondering, would it make sense to, like, perhaps, you know, in addition to have, you know, I have precious metals on hand, but would it make sense to have, like, the Canadian dollar or the Swiss franc on hand for currency exchange?
Sure. You know, in fact, you get very little interest anyway on Swiss francs, so, you know, if you put them in the bank, it's almost the same as keeping them in your sock drawer. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense to keep, you know, you can keep gold bullion and silver. Yeah, sure, you can keep Swiss francs. I mean, whenever I travel, you know, a lot of people when they travel on, you know, are out of the country, they usually try to take the cash they have and get it back. I try to take back whatever foreign currency I have. I still have RMB from 2 years ago from China. I have, you know, different currencies, and I just have them, you know.
Right.
You know, because I figure, you know, why even go and lose the exchange? You know, they're just appreciating against the dollar. It's just currency that I have, and, yeah, you know, why not have it?
All right. You know, great. My second question is a little different regarding the Perth Mint Certificate Program. I was reading Michael Maloney's book on investing in gold and silver, and I was just wondering what your thoughts were. There's one page in his book where he's actually really not crazy about certificate programs. Are you familiar with his comments about discouraging?
Yeah, well, there's been people that have criticized the Perth program, and I think it's a great program. You know, I recommended it. I have money there myself. But I also have, you know, my own gold company. I launched Euro-Pacific Precious Metals. It's up and running. It's doing pretty good now. It's growing. They sell for physical delivery. So if you want to have certificates and you want to have some money, some gold stored for free in Australia, have it out of the country as an extra element of safety, great. If you don't trust that program, if you want to have all your gold in your possession, in your basement somewhere, I'll ship it to you from Europac Precious Metals. So I got you covered either way.
Well, that's great. All right, I guess I'll let you go.
All right, well, thanks for your call. We're running out of time anyway. Again, anybody who's interested in learning about the investment opportunities at Euro-Pacific Capital, whether it's precious metals, foreign stocks, my managed accounts, mutual funds, we got plenty of brokers eager to talk to you, to discuss the risks, figure out if my strategy is suitable for you. Give us a 727-7922. It's 800-727-7922. Pick up, if you don't have the new book that's out, the little book of Bull Moves, pick that one up. If the new one has the yellow cover, if you never bought the first one, if you already own the first one, you don't need it. Crash Proof 2.0, and if you haven't got How an Economy Grows and Why it Crashes, make sure and get that book. In fact, get two copies because you're going to want to have one to give away. Anyway, thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. It's been Peter Schiff, Wall Street Unspun.